Well, that was a great lunch. Everybody knows that the after lunch class is always the hardest. I'm all asleep. Oh, yes. Whatever. Where we got to, and we looked at chapter, we got up there on chapter 4 at the end of the second class. And what we're doing is following through. At the beginning of the chapter, he had looked at the oppression that people get who are mistreated unjustly. And they're oppressed, almost better off to be a stillborn death than that. And then looked at the fact that people go after their own oppression, that there are folks of this life who like workaholics to the point that they oppress themselves. And he saw that, you know, what a shame that is, that those people are so alone in life. They've been striving for so much, thinking they would attain what they wanted, and in the end, they didn't get it. It was all vanity and striving after the wind. But they deprived themselves of good, you know, and they never really asked the question because they don't have the wisdom to be able to look back like Solomon would and be able to figure out, why am I doing this? What is this all for? He then led into the value of looking at teamwork, which is a better approach to life than trying to be the best. And I think that's really what he's contrasting, is that there were those people who were like the workaholics who were out there trying to be the best, which, you know, to the young people, I would suggest to you that this is the kind of thing you'll hear in school all the time, where they're always like, be your best, be the best you can be, and you'll hear the counselors telling you to go out there and strive for whatever you want to do, go out there and do it, and they push that a lot in education. But Solomon looks back at this and says, wait a minute, this may not be worth it. You strive to go out there and be the best. That might be an over extreme rather than just accepting the fact that you do your job, you work as you should, and take the time to enjoy the gifts that God has given us. I think that's really what he's trying to do at the end of chapter 4. And you'll see as we move into chapter 5 that he builds on that. This is actually a thematic area right there as he's going through looking at these common problems. These problems that he experienced and he saw people going through, these were the things that he noticed in his kingdom when people came in and problems he's trying to work through about what motivates people in life. And he saw that a lot of us are motivated by trying to outdo our neighbors. We're motivated by that, I want this and I want that. And that's what the marketing is all based on. And he looked at this idea that you're trying to go it alone. You want to be the best that you can be. And I think he really tackles that specific concept and then moves into that in chapter 5 as well. So the problem with trying to be the best, you know, when you look at that, because we want to do good in life, we want to be useful people in our families and ecclesias, but you don't necessarily have to strive to be the best. God doesn't need the best. He can actually provide the best if he wants to. And you find that out all the way through Israel. When you go back and you look, for example, at the kings, and you find out, well, the way God set up the kings is that this king would have a son, and that son would be the king. Or you go back and look at the priesthood. God just picks a family. Aaron, I'll use you and your family. You're going to be all the priests. And it's like, you know, thereafter, all kinds of people could have come along and said, well, we would make better priests than those, but God picked Aaron's family and said, I'll use them. He doesn't need the best. What he needs is people that are willing to work. And I think you can see that, and Solomon finally realized that you don't need to go after that and be the best. Because what that might do is it might involve too much of your time and your work, and it pulls you away. Maybe you don't have time for your own family or your ecclesia because you're so involved in striving to be the best. And you see that today in people that go into the Olympics. I don't know whether you ever watch any of the stories on what life is like for some of them, but they really give their lives to this. And parents give their lives to their kids and train them to be the best. And you wonder, like, is it really worth it in the end when you look at what they had to go through? They're enslaved to what they're doing. And sure, you end up getting the fame for a while so that everybody of our generation will know the Michael Phelps. And you know, like, what he accomplished. But in 50 years... is anybody even going to care? And this is what Solomon had the wisdom to see. This is just fleeting for the moment. It's just temporary. It doesn't last. It doesn't go into eternal life at all. It's just fleeting for the moment. And in a few years goes by and everybody's forgotten who they are. And he figured this out. I think a lot of times in life, we never think that deep. We just live for the moment. We're trying to survive life right now. He's looking way beyond just the moment. So he goes at the end of the chapter, in chapter 4, where we end up, and he says, look at, and he starts in verse 13, and he's looking at the fact that, well, better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will not be admonished anymore. So the old and foolish king, even though he's the king, he's got all this position, he's not willing to learn. He's not teachable anymore. Far better to have a poor and wise youth who's willing to learn from wisdom and apply this. Because this guy, he comes out of his prison to be the king, this young youth right there. And although he was born poor in his kingdom, and this man, because he's willing to learn and whatever, the people are willing to take him. And so what he's trying to show us in this end section right here is that you might be really, you might work your way up and be this famous king. You might be somebody who's attained the fame and power, these things that we wish that we could have. And what happens in the end is that people would rather take somebody who's teachable, a younger person, and replace you with them and just put you up there instead. They don't really care how good you were. They'll take somebody else and fill them in for you. And the next generation that comes along that picks the younger guy, after a few years, they won't appreciate him either. And they'll move on to somebody else. That what you're striving for is striving after wind. This is just going to blow away in the end, and people won't even remember you. And instead, they'll move on to the next person. Everybody is replaceable. And that's how life goes. No matter how much we give our time to our companies, to whatever we're working with, and even in our ecclesias sometimes, you find out that everybody is replaceable. And God can easily bring other people in and replace us. So don't waste your time, as he's going to end up this section in chapter 4, striving for individual fame and glory. Give it up, because it's just for the moment. It's fleeting. It's a striving after wind, or as he calls it in the last verse. This is vanity, a grasping for the wind, because it's just like it's just like smoke that's there. It's like a wind that's there for a moment. There's really nothing to hold on to that's substantial at all. Now, what that does then is it moves us into chapter 5. And what he's going to do in chapter 5 is build on this. And I never saw this connection before. But in chapter 5, we used to use these passages a lot about being, and a lot of you know about chapter 5 because you know it talks about, you know, serving God. Because now we're moving into a section of Solomon's life we can identify with, all right, when you go to worship. And we think, all right, he's going to tell us about worshiping God. But what he's really doing at this point is he's now switching to very personal exhortations, and he's going to apply this in our life. He's going to take this general concept about striving for this individual fame and glory, being one of these people that like oppresses themselves to the point that you like work to get this position, and you've like you don't even ever ask, like, what is this for? Why am I doing this? And so now in chapter 5 is when he first uses the word you. Not that you noticed that, but now you're going to see in chapter 5, walk prudently when you go into the house of God and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools. And in verse 2, be not rash with your mouth. So he's switching now to a very personal application to this, it to us, because we're going to learn something from this. Now, what he says about going into God's house and going there to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, those of you that like the word studies, you might find it interesting to see that word for hear is the same word that's used in obey. Back in 1 Samuel 15, where Samuel said to Saul that to obey is better than sacrifice. In fact, most of the times it's used about obey. And when it's used about listening or hearing, it's more to do with, like, as a parent, when you would tell your child who made a mistake and we'd say, well, didn't you listen to me? And what we really mean by that is, didn't you hear me? And so in the Hebrew, the word for like hear or listen and obey were almost like the same word. So the stress of the word isn't just to hear, it's to obey. That when you go to the house of God, you go there to obey rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools. Because you got to watch what you say in this one. You know, God is in heaven and you're on earth. Now, what he's doing here isn't just giving us counsel on worship. What he's doing is building on chapter 4 about not going after individual fame and power. Don't think you're going to be the kind of person that will like work, and then you're going to get this job of ecclesial life, or you're going to get some position, and you're going to have a position of power and authority and things like that, because it's so fleeting. And that's not what God really wants. What he wants is obedience. He wants people that will obey him. And as you follow through chapter 5, you can see here God is in heaven and you are on earth. So again, this is all this personal. Therefore, let your words be few. For the dream comes through much activity. Now, when he says that the dream comes through much activity, what he's talking about is the fact that what happens is that when you're so stressed out about your position and you're so worried about what you're going to do and get, that what that does is it adds stress to our life, and when we're stressed out, we go into dreaming. And most people think that's what he's actually aiming at right here, that this is going to cause stress to your life. If you're worried about your personal fame, your personal honor, your personal riches, and you think you're going to do this from like back in chapter 4, instead of going the teamwork approach, you're going to be all stressed out. This is going to cause you to dream like that. And just like the dreams come from that, so too many words cause one to speak foolishly. So I really think that what's happening here is he isn't just giving counsel on how we worship. He's giving counsel about what are your goals and your aspirations when you go to meeting. What are you going there for? You know, there's some brethren right now that are sitting there, some of the young people, that maybe you think you'd like to give the classes someday. Maybe you'd like to be the person that gets up here and speaks, like me. And you know, I just get talk. I can talk forever. I'll let you want to stay tonight. But some of us might be thinking, well, that's like something you want to attain to, like it's really like a prominent thing. But you know, in our community, what happens is that we take speakers like this and we put them into situations to where we hold them in high esteem, like, wow, if you know all that, you must be a really religious person and really godly. And it could be a facade. It could be a total fake. And it could be that, you know, we've got weaknesses then that end up coming out as a result of this. And we've seen in our own community where some of our brethren that have prominent positions are put into situations then where the weaknesses become exposed. And it's not the simple thing that some of us think. And it's not the thing that you really want to attain to, that I want to be able to do that. Or maybe you want to be the recording brother of your ecclesia. And you think, wow, if I could be the recording brother, I want to get up to that position. And Solomon's trying to say, wait a minute, when you go to a meeting, what are you going there for? Why do you go? Are you the organist that goes there so that everybody can hear you play all these things and they think that you're a really good organist? Or maybe you're the presiding brother that wants to like really do a super job of presiding, but not for God. It's so that people will look at you and you will have individual fame and power. And he's warning us that when you go to meeting, don't go for those reasons. Now, who do you think of that would do that in the New Testament? This is the exact problem Jesus ran into with the scribes and the Pharisees, the hypocrites, because they stand on the street corners and they offer their big prayers. They go into meeting with their big gowns on and they like those prominent positions. And Solomon sees way back here, this isn't the approach we want to have. We don't go to meeting for those things. Oh no, you better be careful when you go to meeting. And when he brings up the vows, see, some people think he's just like talking about, you know, vows and just, you know, counsel on worship. I think what he's talking about is that when you go to meeting, don't be the kind of person like a Pharisee who's going to walk into meeting and say, oh, I'm going to vow to God and let everybody know what your vow is going to be. I'm going to do this for God and let everybody know so that, wow, you know, you're going to give all that. And people, then they look at you and they respect you and they think, wow, you're really a religious person and you make it look good. And this is what he saw happening in his day and age. He saw people going into his temple that he now had, and this is what they would do. They would go in for show, and they would put on a good show and a good demonstration, and they fed off of all of that respect that they got from the audience, all of those people looking at them and looking up to them. And Solomon's trying to tell us, look at folks, this is like a striving after wind. This is so momentary and it's fleeting. And it's never going to develop your godly character. You're just striving after something that you really shouldn't go for. So forget about it. Don't offer those kind of vows, because when you offer a vow to God, God expects his vows to be paid. You don't do it to look good. Oh no, when you go to meeting and you make promises and commitments in ecclesial life, he expects you to follow through on those things and do it for him. That's what he wants out of us. And those are the people that he respects and that he works with, not people just walk in and give some big fancy talk and look good for the people and want the respect of the people. So I really think that's actually the context of chapter 5, which I've never seen that before, about he's actually building on a case, because he must have seen this is what drives people in life. So many of us are driven by the kind of public audiences and the respect that we can get. You look at politicians today. This is what's going on in our elections. You know, this is a popularity contest. I saw this in school where they'd have things for like, you know, whatever the election might be for the kids at school. It was always, it's a popularity contest. That's what they became, no matter what you're electing in school. And the same kind of thing can happen in ecclesial life. And Solomon's warning is, don't do that. Don't go down that road. that when you make commitments in ecclesial life and you make promises to God, you fulfill those promises to God, and that's your responsibility. So you look at Proverbs 25, you know, that he was warned there as well, because you know, you can see the connection with Solomon and his Proverbs, that it's a snare for a man to devote rashly something as holy and afterward to reconsider his vows. And I think that's actually what his warning is here in chapter 5, because God's going to hold us accountable. Now, in our versions, when it talks about God and his angels, it's in verse 5 when he said, "Don't be rash with your mouth and cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error." So the messenger there is probably the angels. And Solomon has in mind the fact that when you go to meeting and you make these public displays, the angels are watching everything you do. And when you make promises to them, you better fulfill your promises. "For why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity. But instead, fear God." Don't get into the popularity contest of ecclesial life, and it's not going to get you anywhere. And what we should be doing is fearing God. Now, you'll notice he says, "but fear God." That's going to come up a number of times in Ecclesiastes. It'd be one of those things you could like underline and circle and color, because you know by the time you get to chapter 12, you know that's going to be his bottom line, is that fear God and keep his commandments. He's coming to this idea that this should drive us to serve God rather than be driven by the fleeting moments of, you know, some popularity thing. So you do get elected this, so you do get into this position in ecclesial life. What is that? It's like this all it becomes is another opportunity for God to work on our lives. So we don't want to aim for those kind of things in ecclesial life for popularity reasons. We want to do them because we're serving God. We fear him, and we're there to help the ecclesia. We're a team player. This is where you see that two are better than one and three are even better than two, because you're there to help the group, not just to see how far you can get in life. Now, just to back this up, the next thing he goes on to in chapter 5, you can see that after dealing with the vanity of looking for the fame, of making some fancy vow and getting this popularity, the very next thing he goes into is the vanity of riches and honor. And you can see this is where he's flowing in chapter 5. He doesn't want us to get hung up in this popularity, this individual fame and glory and riches that so many people of this world get caught up in. So again, in verse 8, if you, so there again, this is personal now. He's trying to bring us exhortations. So if you see, in this case, in verse 8, the oppression of the poor and the violent and the perversion of justice and the righteousness in a province, and do not marvel at the matter. For high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. So when you watch injustices like that, and you see these kinds of things going on, that's okay. You're going to see this kind of stuff in life. But instead, what you want to do in verse 8, is that you want to go back, and what you want to do is you want to see these injustices and realize that God is going to watch over all of this, and he's going to use this to his benefit. So yeah, poor people, they are going to be oppressed. There is going to be oppression, which is like back in chapter 4 where he started this original section. You are going to see violence against people that you wish you didn't have to see, and perversion of justice and righteousness. You're going to see those things because people's focus is on their own personal fame, their own personal glory, and the power that they yield. And this is the way life is going to be. But in the end, what will happen is that the higher officials, in verse 8, higher officials are watching over them. What he saw in the land is he saw, you're going to see some people that are in charge of a little group of people, and they might abuse those people in some way and take advantage of them. But you know, when you realize, you look up the ladder, there's somebody over top of them, and you know what? They're doing the same thing. Now, I know you've probably seen this in the workforce. You see this happening in businesses. You know, we saw this in education. Well, there's always somebody further up who can now see, oh, wow, I can use them to accomplish something for me. And people take advantage of them. And it just keeps going on. And even in the end, the king, in the end, can profit from all of those things. The focus that he goes to then in verse 9 is that, look, the profit of land is for all, and the king himself is even served in the field. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This is also vanity. So immediately he goes to this idea that if the goal and the motive was that you can take advantage of these people here because you can become richer, And then the next guy up takes advantage of that next group so that he can become richer. If our focus was like that, if you love silver, you won't ever be satisfied with silver. And he who loves abundance with increase, it just isn't going to work, and it's all vanity. Because in verse 11, when the goods increase, you think like, well, if I only got this extra bit of money, or if I only had a little bit more stuff, if I had a little bigger house, or whatever that might be, you think those things are going to satisfy you? Here's what happens. You never get satisfied, because with the increase, if you end up being more prosperous and God blesses you that way, all that ends up happening is that they increase who eat them. You have more people coming to the table, because now you can share with even more. And more people come to the table and they eat off of your table. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? And that's Solomon's question. Now you can imagine how he saw this play out as the king of the nation, and he watched this going on down through his kingdom, that he just saw as he got bigger and bigger and bigger in terms of all of his projects and all the things he had going on. All he did is had more and more people who were living off of him. And he saw that, well, this doesn't really solve anything, because you just have a bigger group of people, more responsibilities of folks that are wanting to get more off of you. You find this in our country, like somebody wins the lottery and all of a sudden they have all this money, and immediately all these family members they didn't even know existed come out of the woodwork, and they're thinking, oh, they get a piece of that, and they're going to find out how they can benefit from somebody winning the lottery. That's the kind of thing we see in our country, but the same kind of thing would go on in a business life. So he then goes on in verse 12 there, that the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep, because he saw that what will happen with the abundance of the rich is you lay on your bed, you start to think about, you start to worry about some of these things that you've done, all this stuff that God has given you, and then you got to figure out, well, how do you share it with other people? And you go through things in life that the other people never had. Whereas the sleep of the laboring man is sweet, because he's been out there, he's working, he's tired, he goes to sleep. The rich people have all this to consider about what are they going to do with it all. And they probably, I think he's also thinking about in relation to oppression, that some of these people must, at least when they're trying to go to sleep, they must think about the poor people they've oppressed in order to get to this position where they have all this money. So in verse 13 then, he goes on, there's severe evil which I've seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt. So now here again, he's looking at oppression of the other people, and then somebody's got all this money and they won't share it with somebody else, and they keep it to their own hurt. And in the end, a lot of them end up losing this stuff. The riches, they perish through misfortune. Or he begets a son and there's nothing in his hand. And as he came from his mother's womb, naked he shall return. So all this focus on riches, this, you know, that mattered so much to people, Solomon sees it as just like a striving after the wind. And in the end, God can just take it all away and it's all gone. And all the stuff that you work for is just blown away in a moment. And then he sees this severe evil then in verse 16. This is also a severe evil, that just exactly as he came, so he shall go. And so that's how this man ends up who had labored. So at the end of verse 16, what profit has he who labored for the wind? All his days he shall eat in darkness, and as much sorrow and sickness and anger, because in the end, God could take it all away just like that. So what's the point then of striving for all these riches, all this extra stuff, if in the end God can take it all away? That isn't what's really going to give us happiness and satisfaction and profit. So then down in verse 18 then, he moves on and has a look at enjoying of your labor. And here's what I've seen. So here we go again with now personal experience. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. So instead of being the kind of person that's out there to get the most for you, take advantage of other people to get there, even if it's the kind of thing where you're like an ecclesial life, you're worrying about fame positions and you're worried about public opinion and all those things, his warning is, look, don't go that route, and instead just enjoy what God has given you. Eat and drink and enjoy the good of your labors in which you toil under the sun, of which God gives you, for that is your heritage. He found that that would be a much more satisfactory way to live life than to be striving after all this other stuff that in the end is not going to give us satisfaction. It's interesting, I skipped over that passage in Timothy about the love of money, and it may be worth at least noting that You know, when you look at Timothy and you're wondering, like, why is that even thrown in there in 1 Timothy 6, that the love of money is the root of all evil? It appears as though Timothy was being pressured in ecclesial life. Well, like the Apostle Paul, Timothy was in an ecclesia, and he was funded by the people. They had a paid ministry back then. Imagine the pressures put on paid ministers to speak things that the audience who is paying want to hear, much like politics today. And when Paul wrote that to Timothy in the context of 1 Timothy 6, he's warning them that, look, don't get into this money trip. You do that, what will end up happening is that other people will have the power to oppress you if you go that route, because you're going to be worried about what you say publicly, because you've got to appease those people that are funding you. And it can be the same way in ecclesial life if that's our motive. If we're driven by public opinion and what people have to say, we won't necessarily speak God's word. We won't be honest about what God's word has to say about issues in our community, because we're afraid to say things that are unpopular and may not get us elected again to that position. And instead, we've just got to come forth and be honest and say, this is what God has. This is what God has to say. That's actually some of the practical outworking of some of these things that he's looking at on a basis of looking at money and riches and public fame. So in verse 19 then, that every man whom God has given these riches and wealth and given him the power to eat of it and receive his heritage, rejoice in his labor, it's the gift of God. So if God does give you wealth, if he does give you riches, not because you necessarily were the workaholic, but because God put you in a position where you were blessed in your company, or as a farmer, he gives you a good year, and God gives you the riches. Even though you save time for your family, for your ecclesia, and everything, and he just hands it to you. Well, you don't have to sit there and feel bad, like, well, you know, what am I going to do now? It's okay to enjoy those things, share them with other people, and rejoice in what God has given you, because this is something God has given you, and it is your heritage. And you'll notice that he keeps bringing this up. This is your heritage. It is a gift from God. For he will not dwell unduly all the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. This is God's blessing to you. If you're one of those people for whom God has blessed you like that, rejoice and enjoy it and give thanks to God. But in the midst of all that, be content and happy. Don't be thinking about what else you could have. And that's Solomon's just trying to give us his wisdom about, if you want a happy life, accept what God has given you and don't worry about all the other stuff you could have. Very similar to Paul in Hebrews 13 about being content with the things that we have. You let your conduct be without covetousness in verses 5 and 6. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So that we can boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear. What can man do to me? And Paul would write that at the end of Hebrews as they were ready to go through all kinds of persecution. He's warning them that when the troubles come and when things get rough, that's going to be okay. God will get you through it. Faith, chapter 11, will help you endure to the end. But in the end, be nice to people and be content. You know, entertain strangers unaware at the beginning of the chapter. And let your conduct be without covetousness. Don't be wishing you could have all this other stuff you don't have. You won't have a happy life, and you won't be a pleasant person. People will know it by the way you treat them, because you'll always be disappointed in life. You look at life as the cup is half full or half empty instead of half full. And that's how people see life. You're the kind of person that's wishing you could have more all the time, and you don't have the happiness of God, the joy of God in your heart, because you're always worried about having more. So in chapter 6 then, what he does is he keeps moving on again with this same theme about being content. These chapters actually flow right through to the end of chapter 6. So he sees another evil that I've seen under the sun that is common among men. So these are things he has witnessed, common human problems. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor. So you've got all these things that you wanted so bad, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all of his desires, yet God doesn't give him the power to eat of it. But a foreigner consumes it. It's vanity and an evil affliction. So he saw this as being like, this may happen. It's almost like an injustice that God gives you all this stuff and he sets you up, and then all of a sudden he takes it away and some stranger comes in and takes care of all and takes over all your stuff. And I really think he probably figured from like some of the Proverbs, this wasn't supposed to happen to godly people. You know, but this is how he sees the fact that we've got to learn to be content. And if God takes it away, he takes it away. In verse 3, if a man begets 100 children And he lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, and his soul is not satisfied with goodness. Or indeed, he has no burial. I say that a stillborn child is better than he. For it comes forth in vanity, departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. So he looks at the fact that, look, you could be better off as a stillborn child than going through that. You, as opposed to living 2,000 years, you live a long time, but you don't get a chance to experience God's goodness. And Solomon, you know, he's coming from this perspective of thinking that everybody should be able to experience some of this goodness that comes from God. But the secret in the end was to learn to be content. For though it's not seen the sun or known anything, in verse 5 there, this says, more rest than that man, even if he lives 1,000 years twice over, but has not seen goodness. Do not all go to one place. And now he's back to this issue that everybody ends up in the same place. We're all going to the same place. We're all headed to the grave. And so he's looking for the fact that this child, in this case, comes forth and would be better off than somebody who never sees God's goodness. Because he wants people to be able to experience some of God's goodness. And if you're the kind of person that you're always after more, you're always striving to get more stuff, more stuff, more stuff, and then for a while even God gives it to you, but then he doesn't let you enjoy it. If you can't like pull back from that for a minute and realize God took that away, he's trying to teach me something from that, what will end up happening is you become so frustrated, you become angry at God, and you would be better off being a stillborn child than go through that experience. And he wants to save people that. But the secret to it, the secret is to learn to be content. For in verse 7, all the labor that a man does, in verse 7, all the labor is for his mouth, and yet his soul is not satisfied. For what more, in this case, when he's looking at the prophet, what more profit has the wise than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Somebody who's known for like walking before God, better than the sight of the eyes of the wandering of desire. This is all vanity and a striving after the wind. So he's looking in verse 7 that some people, they work hard just to get the food they want, but they never seem to get enough. Because if your basic strategy of life is to satisfy that momentary desire, and I want to work for this, and I want to get this, once you get to that point and you get it, what your mind will do is it will just jump to the next thing and say, well, I want that next. That's next on the list. And then you go after the next thing. And so you're just never satisfied because the human desire just never has enough. But even the wise, they never have enough as well, because if that's what you're after in this case. And the poor people who are wise, they still desire more as well. This is a common human problem. We never have enough. We always want more. For some of us, we might have 25 pairs of shoes, and that's not enough. You say another pair of shoes at the store, and that's going to go with this outfit. And it's like, this is the human spirit. And, you know, we all know it. We sort of laugh at it. But Solomon's analyzing this in terms of deeper issues of our life. Where are our perspectives really at? What are our goals and aspirations at? Are we really seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness? Because if we are, we'll be content with what God has given us. And we won't be driven to get this and get this and get more and get more. So he ends up at verse 9 then. He says, look, you're better off. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. It's better off just accepting what you have, what you can see, what you've got, what God has given you in front of you, as he keeps saying. Enjoy life. Accept God's good gifts. Accept that instead of the wandering of desire. Because the wandering of desire, it just never ends. And this is all vanity and grasping for the wind, because that's where we're at in life. Now, you know, in saying all these things, you know, I know I've been through these things myself. You know, this is stuff I've been through. I know that this is how my mind works. And I'm sure you have too. And as Solomon said, I saw this stuff. This is common to man. These are common problems that we run into. And he's trying to get us to rethink that this is not really going to bring us happiness. Now, I think as we get older, a lot of us find it easier to look back on our life and say, oh yeah, that thing I wished I could have had, when I finally got it, it really didn't give me any happiness like I thought it would. Maybe for a couple of days, a few weeks, even for a year, but then after that, it really wasn't what I thought it would be. And Solomon's trying to help us and not have to go through that. The problem with all of us is that we can read this in the text, and we can know the Bible says this, but then in the end, we all go out, and to some extent, we all try to do it. And this is the way we are. And so I don't think he's going to be able to save us from all of the mistakes of life. You can't just like read through Ecclesiastes and just say, oh yeah, I get it. I'm never going to go after those things. Because all of us will to some extent. But what he can do is he can help you when you're going through that period where you wished you could have had it. He can help you deal with it. Or when you thought it was going to bring you happiness and it didn't, you don't have to get so depressed in life, because you can now identify and say, oh yeah, I remember that. Solomon said that's what would happen. He's right. He's right. And I think we can all look back and learn. I think probably Christ is the only one who was able to look at this, really read it, and take it for what it had to say. And he never got hung up in all these issues. He just stayed away from all of them and had learned to be content. As the Apostle Paul would write to the Philippians, and you wonder, like, how could Paul lead the life that he did, where he's up on cloud nine at times, and he's out there doing God's work, and he's witnessing and working out miracles, and then other times he's struck with stones, and he's left for dead, and he goes through all these things you read about in his life, of the ups and downs of his life, and he's sitting there in prison, and he's writing a letter, and he wasn't taken care of very well, and he tells the Philippians to rejoice in the Lord greatly, in verse 4, of chapter 4, verse 10, I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now after length you've revived your concern for me. For you were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. Not that I complain of want, for I've learned in whatever state I am to be content. I really think that's what Solomon is after here. He's trying to help us understand that no matter what you get in life, if your focus is always for, like, I want this and I want this, you'll never have contentment. You'll never have the peace of God that passes all understanding that the Apostle Paul had learned to have. He learned to be content wherever he was. Whatever he got to eat that day, wherever he got to sleep that night, he learned to be content and he didn't complain. You know, and look at our lives, brothers and sisters. Look at how easily we complain. We're not content people. Something goes wrong and, you know, the heat system's off and it's too cold in here. We're thinking, oh, I'm too cold, I'm freezing. You know, and something goes wrong and dinner's not ready on time. And it's like, what's the matter? Our dinner's not ready. And we complain. We do. We complain about the simplest things of life. So do I. And we're just like, we're so used to having everything just right and be taken care of. And our natural reaction is to complain. And these godly people found out that that's not the solution. It's not the secret, as Paul would say, when he talks about he had learned the secret of life. He learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and want. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, or in him who strengthens me. Because the secret is to accept the fact that whatever God brings to our life, it's okay. It's right for us. And we don't have to complain about it. But we can learn to thank God for what we have, rejoice in the good things that we have, and realize, you know, we're so much better off than almost everybody else in the world. And it's so true. Just look around the world. Look at the people down in South America, Central America. You go down and look at our brothers and sisters in Africa and what they go through. Other places, you look at what the folks are going through in New York right now. We have it made. And yet we still, in our minds, we find room to complain and we're just not content people as a person. And that's the secret to happiness with God, is that you learn to be content, believing and trusting that whatever God brings into your life, it's right for me. It wasn't unfair. It's what I needed. It's what I needed to change in order to become one of God's children. This is what Solomon, I really think, what he had come to, what the Apostle Paul had come to. I think this is what got Joseph through all of his things. You look back at Joseph's life and you wonder, like, how did he put up with those brothers? How did he go through all those experiences, being sold to the Midianites, mistreated in Potiphar's house? And one thing after the next, he's trying to do the right things and God just keeps throwing another curveball at him. And he gets to the end of his life and he's just totally forgiven his brothers when they show up. And they can't figure out, like, how did he ever forgive us? And then years later, 15 years later, his dad dies. And the brothers come to him in Genesis 50 and they say to him, look, you know, our dad said to us before he died, you really should forgive your brothers for what they did. And like, don't you, you know, Joseph looks at him, he starts crying. He says, don't you realize I forgave you all along? Because that's the confidence that he had, that whatever happened in his life, God was behind it. He even goes on and tells him, look at, you meant it for evil. He goes out and tells him. I find that really an interesting concept, that he could look at his brothers and he could say right to their eyes, I know you had evil intentions when you did this against me, but I just forgave it, wrote it all off, because you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And he saw, he had the wisdom to see that even though they had bad intentions, God was going to bring good out of that. That in everything, God works for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. Joseph had the wisdom to realize that as he was going through those problems. That's amazing when you look at his life. So Solomon goes on. in chapter 6, and he goes on and he says, look, God knew all along. God had this plan for a long time. So don't argue with God's plan. Chapter 6, in verse 10, whatever one is, for he has been named already. So he's looking back at the fact, whatever one is, he's been named already. In other words, God knew him all along. This isn't just an in general thing. For it is known that he is man. In other words, God understands what men are like. He knows what it's all about. And he cannot contend with him who is mightier than he. See, you know he's got God in mind. God had determined all these events all along. He's been watching the whole thing as your life plays out. And he's got it all planned. He's known what's in man. He knows what we're like. And he knows what we need. And you can't contend with him who is mightier than he. You can't contend with God. What are we going to do? Say we know more than God? That we know what we need better than God knows what we need? Is that what we're going to try to tell God at some point? It's the kind of thing that Job wondered at some point. And in the end, in verse 11, he says, look, since there are many things that increase vanity, really what that means right there in verse 11 is that it's more like the more you guys say, the more we have to say, the more we complain, the more we say about what God is doing, then the more vain it becomes. It just increases the vanity. And how is man the better? It really doesn't help the situation at all, no, at all. For in verse 12, who knows what is good for man in life? Who knows? Do you really know what's good for you? Do you really know what you need? And even if you did know, would you have the faith and the confidence to pull it off? That's an amazing question to ask ourselves. What if God told us all the things that we needed and what our family needed? Would you actually have the spiritual strength to actually do that? I mean, you look at Abraham willing to offer Isaac. If you knew that this is what you had to do to save your children, that you were going to have to kill your son, would you even be able to do it? Abraham was. He had the confidence that God would resurrect him from the dead. You look at Jacob and you wonder, like, Jacob holds the angel, he wrestles with him, holds on to him, like, bless my family. You know, imagine if the angel told him, that, look, you're going to have to lose Joseph for a while. He's going to go down to Egypt. And he goes, here's all the things that your family's going to go through. You know, you think really Jacob could have done that? You know, he wouldn't have wanted to. You thank God that we don't have to make those decisions and we don't have to be the one that implements them. Thank the fact that the angels, those ministers that are out to minister for the sake of those that are of salvation, they're out there doing their job and they're taking care of us all the time, because only God knows what's good for us and we have to trust him. Whatever he brings is what we needed and it's what's going to turn us into children for him. So that's the way he ends up chapter 6 at this point, and that's pretty much the way he finishes that section. You look in Ephesians 1, the Apostle Paul, you know, he's commenting on these same things. Says, Paul, I really think out of all the Bible characters, when you look at, well, you know, some of these key people like a Joseph or an Abraham or you know, other Bible characters, the Apostle Paul seems to have really caught on to a lot of these things that Solomon is trying to tell us about. And whether he learned them through his experience of striving to be that famous Sadducee and or Pharisee as he did, and he wanted to be that person, and God knocked it all out and sought and taught him it was striving after wind. Maybe Paul saw this really well. But you can see in Ephesians 1 when he talks about God making known to us the mystery of his will. Of his will, it's a mystery of his will, because now, you know, we're learning about what God's will really is according to his good pleasure which he purposed in Christ to be put into effect when the times have reached their fulfillment. To bring all things in heaven and earth together under one head, even under Christ, because Paul saw that God's plan all along was to unite the Jew and the Gentile, the true Israel of God, and bring them together. That in him we were also chosen, having been predestined according to the plan of him who works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will. And that's how Paul saw life. That's how he saw his own life. Whatever happened to him, whether he was stoned or whether he was, you know, held in high esteem by an ecclesia, or whether Judaizers came in and just wreaked havoc of what he had done, he understood that it was all according to the purpose of God. And that's the confidence Paul had, and that's what gave him the peace of God that passes all understanding. So what do we do, brothers and sisters and young people? What happens when God brings difficult times in our life? What happens when all of a sudden, you know, we get blindsided and we're struck with disease? What are we going to do? You know, what happens when somebody that we love dies and we didn't expect it? You know, other times we know it's coming. So what if it's a surprise? What if all of a sudden, you know, in the next week you lose your job or your home? Look at our brethren in New York right now. They're probably wondering this kind of thing, that maybe a flood came through and just took away all their possessions. Just like that, it's gone. Or you have marriage problems or problems with your children. See, our natural reaction is, that's not fair. Because we look around at other people and we say, they didn't have to go through this. They're not going through it right now. And we compare ourselves with each other. And that's the huge mistake that Solomon saw was going on. If you do that, you never realize that, wow, God's custom designed this. This is right for me. And we question God's righteousness. We question whether he is really right. But what faith does, what God's trying to do with us, is he's trying to get us to understand that we've got to trust him. He's our Father. He loves us. He's training us. He's disciplining us as the ultimate Father. And he's trying to get us ready for his family forever. He's totally in control. We just have to believe it. And so these are the experiences that he brings into our life. They're to test us. You look at Joseph. And you know, Joseph being sold off by his brothers like that to go down to Egypt. And you look how he would go through what Paul would say, that we know that God causes all things to work together for good. And you can't tell at the moment when you're going through it, but you can look back at it later on. I think that's why some of the older ones here have an advantage in Ecclesiastes over young people, because you have the experience of life and you can realize that this is what God is actually doing. One of the fun ones I've looked at in the past was David and his men. Remember when David wanted to fight with the Philistines and he was going to go up to that battle where Saul was up there in the land, the Philistines are going to come up from the south, they're going to go up and fight in Israel, from this side for you. And they're going to come up and they're going to fight against Saul and Jonathan up there in the land. And David tries to go along with them. And he gets rejected and gets sent back to Ziklag. You know, David and his men, they come back to Ziklag, and what do they find? You know, he finds the whole place has been burned. The Amalekites took all their families, their wives and their little ones. That's what happens when he comes back after he made this decision to go up there. And his men want to stone him. They talk about stoning David. That's what it says in 1 Samuel 30. But David, what he does is he strengthens himself in the Lord. He understood this was a test. You know, he realizes that God's going to bring him through this. Somehow out of all this, God is going to bring good. And God sends him up. He asks God, should we go get him? And God says, yep, go after the Amalekites and go get him. And he goes after him and he rescues every one of them and brings him back. And you know that it was only a week later he's king in Judah. Just like that. This is how God can manipulate people's lives. If we have the faith and the trust and the confidence. Not that it always happens a week later, but David had the confidence to believe that whatever God brought into his life, whatever it was, God was going to make it turn out for good. Even if it meant losing all those people. You trust in the Lord with all your heart, as we were reminded in the prayer earlier. And lean not on our own understanding. In all our ways we acknowledge him, and he will direct our paths. So in chapter 7 that we'll be moving into, I don't know if we get there right now. 7, 8, 9, 10. In chapter 7, maybe I just had a quick look at what he does. Chapters 1 to 6, we're mainly dealing about the vanities of human life and all the frustrations that Solomon is working through. As you move into chapters 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, you're going to see there's a shift in the book. Instead of all this questioning and all this, you know, wondering about what God is doing, he's now going to move into an area in which he's saying, all right, this is what God is doing, and he's moving into a section about teaching us through wisdom of what God's going to try to do. It's more like reading the Proverbs in this case. So you get about how to deal with all these conditions, the frustrations that he had. Here's how you work through it. So he talks in chapter 7 in the first few verses about a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death better than the day of birth. And you wonder, like, well, what is this all about? Why would he say all these different things about, you know, a good name is better than this, the day of death is better than the day of your birth? But what Solomon is after is the fact that when this happens, you know, when you look at, like, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, that's going to last with you more than riches. A good name will last with you all through your life. Your riches can be taken and can be gone and blown away, but your good name will stick with you. He goes on to the day of death is better than the day of death is better than the day of birth. You wonder, like, how could he ever say that? Well, in the day of your death, when your life is finished, all that you had worked at is established, and it's done. It's like the Apostle Paul, I've fought the fight, I've finished the race, and now henceforth there's laid up for me the crown of righteousness. There's no chance anymore that this is going to break off and you're going to lose it all. And so at the day of your death, that's what he's looking at. Now this is a valid thing that you're not going to go back on this. See, this is the area of Ecclesiastes that is so similar to the Proverbs. Many of the Proverbs are lined up thematically like this, but if you don't see the connection of the Proverbs, you don't realize why they're put together. He talks about being serious about life in verse 2, that it's better to, like in chapter 7 at verse 2, to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting. Because when you go to the house of mourning, you get serious. You start thinking about the future. You go to the feasting, you're partying, you're having a good time. Who's ever thinking about their future? Who's thinking about what they're going to do in life? Whereas the house of mourning makes you consider your ways. He talks about sorrow being better than laughter for the same kind of thing, that sorrow can have a good influence on us. He's not saying that it's not good to ever laugh or it's never good to go to the house and feast. He's simply saying, if you think about it, wisdom tells us that these things will help us to change our life better than all the partying, the happiness, and all those kind of things. Wisdom can make you think about these things. So wise people, they go to funerals, and they think at the funeral, wise people go to a funeral. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fools is in the house of mirth. So, you know, when a wise man goes to a funeral, what he does is he thinks, when he's at the funeral, he thinks, you know what? I'm going to end up there too. This is where I'm going to end up being. And he starts thinking about plans, about how I should alter my life, things I should do. I may not have as much time as I thought. Maybe somebody young has died and they're realizing that, wow, this is it. I've got to adjust my life now. And so when you go to these things, when you attend a funeral, a wise person is caused to consider. This is what wisdom will do to you. And it's better to listen to the wise people who reprimand you than the fools who praise you, because if you listen to them, you're going to learn, you're going to grow. And so he's looking at, he's pulled a whole bunch of things right here in a pile about things that will help us change our life, help us grow, help us to develop, help us to become more serious in life. And what he's going to lead into now in chapters 7, 8, 9, and 10 that we'll look at in the next class is how wisdom is going to be so much more beneficial to you than the foolish approach to life. Wisdom will help you get through this. Wisdom will help you look back at all these unfair, all these inequities of life, all these problems that we've already looked at. Wisdom will help you get through this, because you're going to see in this that God is working in it to our benefit, because God loves us and he wants us to be in his family forever. And he'll use those experiences of life to train his children. And it's going to be fun to see that as he gets into chapters 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So we'll leave it there for right now. Thanks.